Good evening, and welcome to Art World Innovators, exploring stories of innovation in the art world. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and you're listening to UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Our guest this evening is illustrator and photographer David Kirshner, a world-renowned zoologist living in Australia and originally from Winnipeg. With his outstanding artistic skills and professional knowledge, he has contributed photographs and illustrations to many publications related to his work and has been a consultant and animal wrangler for a number of film documentaries, such as an episode of the BBC Life in Cold Blood series with David Attenborough, the 92-year-old BBC broadcaster of educational and natural history documentaries. David Kirshner is also a zoo and aquarium interpreter with a strong interest in the conservation of animals. David received the 2015 Whitley Medal from the Royal Zoological Society of New South Wales for his outstanding scholarly zoological publication, Biology and Evolution of Crocodilians, which he lavishly illustrated and co-authored with Gordon Grigg. Speaking with us tonight on his perspective of innovatively combining artistic skills with scientific practice is David Kirshner. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Looking back, what would be your earliest memories of your passion for drawing and alligators?
It's actually quite a funny story. I had a neighbor that lived down the street, Mrs. Greenfield. I think she still lives on the same street. And she was a snowbird. She used to go to Florida every year. And in those days, you were able to buy stuffed alligators. And she had a couple that she bought in Florida as souvenirs. And I was probably about 4 years old, and I used to go down the street to play with them and draw them. So it wasn't the origin of my interest, but it was the first memory I have of being actively interested in both alligators and crocodiles and drawing them.
So where has this passion for crocodilians and wildlife taken you, and how did this inform your innovative artistic development?
Well, growing up, I always knew I'd either be a zoologist or an artist. And when I went to university, I decided that I was going to study zoology. I did a introductory course in fine arts at the University of Manitoba, as well as studied zoology. And then when I finished university, I ended up coming to Australia to do research on crocodiles, to follow my passion. When I finished my PhD, I wanted to get out of academia, and I had this real interest in combining my art and zoology by working in the zoo industry as an interpreter, essentially producing the graphics where I can inform people about various aspects of biology and conservation, and use the art side to explain things, and that's kind of where I took it.
Looking at some of your photographs and illustrations in publications such as the Encyclopedia of Mammals, your illustrations of wildcats or monkeys, for example, are exquisite in how you capture their expressions, their vibrant colors, the lines of their bodies, and the flow of their movements in their natural habitat. How did your extensive knowledge of the biological and physiological makeup of various species of living things help in your ability to capture the details of animal life in your illustrations?
Well, first of all, thank you. my biggest critics are actually the people whose criticism of my artwork I pay most attention to are other animal people, so zoologists and a lot of my colleagues, because they're the ones that understand the animals best. And they seem to love my work. So that, to me, that means more than anything. And I think to portray an animal correctly, you really need to understand how it moves and what the typical expression is. There's a lot of illustrations out there, a lot of paintings out there of wildlife where a person's looked at a static photograph, and the photograph may be taken at an awkward moment, and they've kind of assumed it's a typical pose. Or it's hard to explain, but there's very easy to tell an illustration done by someone that's not very familiar with animals. It's probably the best way to put it.
As far as photography, how did you incorporate photography into your work?
Well, my interest in photography goes back a really long way. And it's when back when everything was done non-digitally, when it was transparencies. And originally, I bought a camera to take photographs of things to use for reference. And so photography wasn't really the hobby in and of itself. And it was around the time I came to Australia that I really started spending a lot of time photographing wildlife and developed an interest in kind of building a library of photographs of different types of wildlife from around the world. And then it kind of became its own hobby, quite apart from my art, from my illustration and painting. And so now it actually competes with my other artistic side.
And do you have a lot of photographs in the encyclopedias or other publications?
Yes, I've got quite a few photographs all over the place in assorted books and in zoos and in displays and in various other places like that.
Where are some of the places that you've traveled to?
I've done a fair bit of traveling around Australia. I've been to South America, particularly Brazil. I've spent a lot of time in Brazil and North America, both Canada, the U.S., Mexico, Southeast Asia, Indonesia, Thailand. I spent a lot of time in Singapore. I was doing some work there. Southern Africa. I'm the Middle East as well. And I've still to go to a place I want to go next, probably India and Sri Lanka will be my next destination. Actually, a couple of years ago, I was working as a consultant, so I had time in my hands. And I decided I was going to catalog my photographs, all my digital photographs. So I was cataloging, I guess, photographs going back to 2003 when I first got a digital camera. So I was using Lightroom to catalog them, cataloging by location, by species. And I've got 150,000 photographs cataloged.
That is quite a lot.
Yes.
Did some of that experience help you in your work that you did with Sir Attenborough and the BBC on the documentary series about animals and natural history? And did these inspire you?
Well, David Attenborough, I don't think he's not as big in North America as he is in places like Australia and the UK. He's massive here in terms of being probably the most respected documentary maker when it comes to wildlife. And my interest kind of goes back actually to stuff I was doing in Australia, where I've got a real interest in mantle lizards. One of my hobbies is I keep and breed a type of lizard called a mantle lizard, which is quite a large, well, the species I keep is quite a large lizard that lives locally to me in Sydney. And I spend a lot of time out in the bush watching their reproductive habits and foraging habits and everything else. And the David Attenborough crew was starting to work on a series on reptiles called Life in Cold Blood. And one of the episodes was on lizards. And the producer was contacting a number of biologists. And a couple of them had recommended that they speak to me because they wanted to do a sequence about lace monitors, a particular species that nests in termite mounds. And so they contacted me. And because I was breeding this, there's certain aspects of their biology that you can't record in the wild, particularly what goes on inside the termite mound. These animals lay nests and they lay their eggs in termite mounds, and you can't really know exactly what day they're going to start hatching out in the wild and set up a camera inside there. So that sort of stuff has to be set up. And we end up setting up a termite mound in my home with eggs that I've got from my captive lace monitors. And so I had a cameraman camping out at my place when they were hatching. And it was a really interesting experience for me in seeing the things that we were doing and how they ended up on the final series. And it made me aware of how much work goes into a documentary as well, because we spent about 2 weeks worth of work, 4 minutes in the finished documentary.
Can you use your creative skills to enhance the goals of organizations associated with your interests for conservation of wildlife or endangered species of crocodiles, for example, with organizations maybe that you're involved in, such as the International Union for Conservation of Nature?
So mostly that's my zoology side, but I do use my artistic hat when I have to explain things to the public. You're trying to explain something complex and trying to simplify it so they understand it better, and I find that that's where the illustration really comes in handy. And so that's where I see my special skill set as being combining the zoology side with the artistic side and trying to explain something, trying to explain a concept. That's where the interpretation comes in.
And what would you advise students who want to combine various professional interests with artistic skills?
That's a good question. For one, I think practice is really important. I think one of the most important lessons I had is it's a bit of a story here, but when I first finished my studies, I just assumed that I'd be able to walk into a position somewhere at a zoo as an interpreter. Because I thought, I've got the zoological knowledge, I've got the artistic skill, why wouldn't they just snap me up? And I got a job at a zoo, working as a zookeeper with the idea in mind that I would develop this position. And I ran into all sorts of, it was a little bit of a struggle, because interpretation wasn't a big thing in zoos in those days. And there was also a lack of experience on my part in both the zoo world and in interpretation. And so I ended up going off on a tangent and working as an illustrator for a while. It was originally going to be an interim job that was going to just carry me over for a year or so until I found other work. And I ended up loving it. It was probably my favorite career ever. where I was just doing illustration work for books and for advertising and for all sorts of things like that. And I ended up doing it for about 14 years. And I don't know if you've ever read a book by Malcolm Gladwell called Outliers. And he talks about the 10,000 hours that people developing a skill set, to take it to the next level, you pretty much have to put in 10,000 hours. And that period of illustration was my 10,000 hours of illustrating. And it really helped me to be able to really quickly, especially with illustration, be able to summarize things really quickly visually. If I want to explain something, then I've got a fair idea of the key features I need to show to explain it quickly without making it too complex. And so I think that level of practice. So then when I stopped working as an illustrator, I went back into the zoo industry, and that's where I've been since then, working mostly as in the field of interpretation.
So it's a good combination. I suppose you almost feel like you might be an instrument of storytelling.
Oh, 100%. And that's probably, it's funny that you should say that, because it didn't occur to me until a few years ago that my whole life is about storytelling, and that sums me up. It's funny. I once had an ex-girlfriend in a moment of anger tell me that my life was one big anecdote. And I think she meant it as an insult, but I kind of went, yes. and now she's an anecdote. but it's true, though. That's what I do. It's storytelling.
It is great. Well, we're just running out of time, so I'd like to thank you very much for being on our show and sharing your intriguing story and insight with us. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you very much, Susan. It's a pleasure.
That was David Kirshner, zoologist, illustrator, and photographer, speaking with us from Australia. For those of you just tuning in, you are listening to Art World Innovators on UMFM 101.5. Our next guest this evening is Liv Valmestad, art and research librarian at the University of Manitoba's Architecture and Fine Arts Library, as well as an artist professor, art historian, and researcher at the university. Liv has an extensive background in the art field with a Master of Library and Information Science from the University of Western Ontario, her Master of Arts from Queen's University in Kingston, a Fine Arts post-BFA diploma from Ringebu College in Norway, a Bachelor of Fine Arts studio from University of Saskatchewan, and her ATCL in piano from Trinity College in the UK. Liv has a diverse range of research interests. As an artist, she is drawn to formalism and abstract modernism. As an art historian, she has lectured at several universities and international conferences with her focus on 19th century paintings, and as a professor with the School of Art. As a librarian, Liv provides references and research sources and assistance to both the School of Art and Architecture. She has been the president of the Art Library Society of Canada, and her ongoing research code project focuses on documenting, geotagging, photographing, and describing the public sculpture on campus. Liv's vibrant and energetic works have been exhibited at the University of Manitoba, the Centennial Concert Hall, Great West Life, the University of Saskatchewan, and more. Liv is speaking with us today about art and architecture from an innovative research librarian and artist perspective. Welcome to Art World Innovators, and thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Oh, thank you, Susan. I'm happy to be here.
You certainly have an extensive background in the field of art, art history, and library science. Can you tell us about your background and research interests, and how you combine your experiences towards such a successful art practice, teaching career, and work as a research librarian?
Well, I started off studying art and had no idea I would end up being an art librarian, but I just followed my interests, and that led into art history, and then I was able to marry all my interests into my present position as the art librarian at the University of Manitoba. And I am fortunate enough to be able to continue my research in my art practice, which I'm able to do in my sabbaticals, as well as presenting on, the public art here on campus. I was also part of the Canadian Centre for Contemporary Art, the board, and we put on a symposium at the Winnipeg Art Gallery called Winnipeg Effects. I was able to do research for the artwork included in the exhibition and talk about it at a conference. So, yeah, I'm able to draw upon my education and experience, and it leads to the research I do in my present position at work.
And it's quite fortunate that the University of Manitoba's library collection is large enough to have many specialty libraries, and one specifically for art and architecture. Can you tell us about the library and some of the specialized resources you've listed accessing information specific to art and architecture?
Well, our collection has over 80,000 monographs, and it's hard to keep track of because we now get journals electronically, but we have over 100,000 journals that we subscribe to from all around the world that cover art, art history, interior design, landscape architecture, city planning, architecture. I would say our collection for architecture is probably the best in the country, or maybe second to McGill, because we do offer a PhD in architecture at the University of Manitoba, as well as the master's in all of the other related fields that I just mentioned. We have an MFA in art, and so that means we usually get more money to buy more library materials. And so we have probably a good collection on art and art history. But we don't have the MA in art history, and if we did, then we could even expand more. But yes, we are very lucky to have a dedicated special library to art and architecture. There's probably not that many of us left in Canada. The trend for the last 20 years or so is to become amalgamated with other libraries, usually the large undergraduate library. I remember when I was a graduate student at Queen's, we actually had the key to our library, which was in Ontario Hall. And now that library, too, has been shut down, and it's part of a larger library, Stouffer Library on campus. So, no, we're very lucky to have this library, and also the students are very lucky to have dedicated librarians that can help them with their very subject-specific research.
They are very lucky. Your site is really informative and quite easy to navigate. How do you organize it? And can you tell us just how much preparation and organization goes into even just one of the subject links?
We do a web page specific to, you know, art now and studio arts, or introduction to art history, or how to research architecture.
Right.
And those take, yeah, quite a bit of time because I do make them from scratch, and they're in a product called LibGuides. It's fun to organize all our resources in terms of electronic links, and then they're all in one spot, and the students can start their research from the guide. And that can include web resources, electronic journals, references to ebooks, and of course, references to the monographs that we have in the library.
So how do the students become more familiar with the library sources, and are there online videos, or do you visit the classrooms to explain them?
We do all sorts of things. I regularly do, I call them kind of a hybrid lecture between information literacy and art history. So I'll do a research lecture on a very specific subject. So I'll be asked to maybe look at Renaissance art and architecture resources, or contemporary art, or resources for city planning. So I usually go into the classroom and show them how to find the information in our library catalog, and then work with maybe a question they have for their essay, and show how it would go about researching it in the various databases and other online tools that we have access to. For the studio courses, they tend to come in because we also like to think of our library as a teaching laboratory. So we love it when they come and actually put their hands on our books that we spend, you know, thousands of dollars on. And so they come in and use these resources, and I show them all of the journals that are pertinent to contemporary art. We build a relationship with them, and they're less intimidated.
Can you tell us how maybe your research projects have contributed to the reference sources of the library, maybe the university public art documentation?
So I have been researching the public art on campus, and I chose to do the outdoor sculptures because a lot of the artwork inside the buildings move, and then they're also a part of special collections. So I decided to do some research on the artists and do web pages for each of the works, and then have people land on these web pages by scanning QR codes that were placed outside of the artworks. And then I also geotagged it so that you could go on to Google Earth or a Google Map, and you would get little pins that would pop up and say, hey, here's a sculpture by Eli Bornstein, or here's another work by Ivan Eyer. So you could take a virtual tour as well as a physical tour. And I've also gotten several grants, and one was to restore one of the sculptures that was on campus. It had been in an exhibition, Expo 67 in Montreal, and it was donated by the Bronfman family, and they donated several sculptures to universities across the country, and we were fortunate to get one. And I had seen this sculpture outside of Fletcher Argue for probably 15 years, and it was basically half of its body was there, and I thought that was the complete work until somebody sent me an original slide, and I realized that half of the body of the sculpture was missing. So I was able to use that archival slide, and with money from Manitoba Heritage and with a whole team of people helping me, we were able to restore the missing piece and attach it and basically conserve it to its original form. And now we're just waiting to get it placed somewhere on campus. That was a very exciting project to be part of.
How much of the library's information is accessible to those outside the university, the faculty and student base? And do you have many researchers from other universities or institutions approach you?
Oh, yes. We have. I get reference questions all the time from people around the country and even from around the world. I had a question from Norway a couple of days ago. They wanted to look at one of the practicums from our architecture students. And unfortunately, we can't even let that out of the library to current students. So that is something that someone has to come in and look at. Our catalogs and our subject guides are on the web, so they're accessible to anyone who has the internet connection. And we have designers and professionals come in all the time to use our materials, to look at the building codes that we have. We have people contacting me about the Winnipeg Building Index, which is an incredible resource, which includes over, let's say, maybe 500 Winnipeg buildings or more. We have images. We have information about the architect. And I'm contacted regularly from people who want to use the images in their scholarship or their articles, as well as my public art site, because I've documented the artworks and I'm regularly requested for images for books and so forth. So, yeah, the collection is very accessible, and people are always welcome to come in and use our resources.
Moving on to your artistic practice, you're also an accomplished artist with an innovative approach and style. And can you tell us about your work and describe a piece so we have a sense of what it would be like to see in person?
Well, I must say my art practice has, you know, it evolves over the years. I came out of a very strong modernist tradition from the University of Saskatchewan and was interested in that notion of kind of a flat picture plane and the tension between that and a perspectival space. I've done everything to like large wooden constructions that are basically pieces of wood cut up with a bandsaw and then mounted together, and then they can be as large as 6x3, and they're triangular dynamic pieces, so they're almost reminiscent of, for me, Russian constructivist works. But I've always been interested in also rhythm, pattern, and shape. So all of that is fed into another big body of work, was looking at Scandinavian mood painting, which I'd written about in my master's thesis for art history, and trying to imbue basically a painting with this a feeling of like evocative landscapes or a mood. And so some of these range from recognizable landscapes to abstract stripes. And on my last sabbatical, I was literally working with line as a common denominator on all of my paintings. So I used very thick gel and did vertical lines on the canvas, and then would paint variations of landscapes that I had seen in the Norwegian Arctic, because I had gotten a grant to go up there. And I was thinking about the line that this boat I took. There's a flotilla of boats that go up and down the coast of Norway, like the Greyhound bus system that used to go, I guess, across the prairies. They've just cut that, a lot of those lines. So I was thinking of the line, the route that that boat company made, and then my line kind of back to Norway in terms of my lineage and my background and my parents, and then the physical line on the canvas and that. So my last exhibition was the Northern Line. So those paintings have a definite kind of mood to them and a linear, strong linear component.
Where did you say you exhibited that?
That was exhibited at the University of Manitoba and at the Piano Nobile Gallery at the Concert Hall. And part of it might be going to the University of Minnesota. We'll see, because they're interested in showing that work because of Scandinavian slant, because a lot of them are of that heritage in Minnesota. So the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis.
So your background and your heritage has a lot of influence in your work?
It does. You know, I feel like I'm kind of one foot in both worlds. I grew up speaking Norwegian until I started school in grade one. And, you know, all of my relatives are in Norway. We're a family of immigrants. My parents immigrated to Canada, and my sisters were born in Norway, and my brothers and I were born in Saskatchewan. So I've always had this pull back and forth, and I've been there a lot. And I guess I've been interested in exploring, you know, ideas of identity and nationalism and what that means, I guess, in terms of art history and then in terms of art at some point.
do you have the opportunity to teach that as a professor?
Funny you should ask. I've given guest lectures at Queen's University on Scandinavian landscape painting, and I've also done it several times here at the University of Manitoba within a 19th century course. I've been invited in to give guest lectures. I have been asked to do an entire course, but I don't have time.
I can't imagine why.
Maybe after I retire, I could do that.
That'd be great.
Because the only other place that really specializes in Scandinavian art history outside of Scandinavia is the University of Minnesota.
What would you recommend for those interested in pursuing a career as a university or librarian?
You go off and do a master's in library and information science. And I think they still have the programs at University of British Columbia, Western, McGill, University of Toronto. There's several in the States. But to become part of a special library, I know when I was interviewed here for my position over 21 years ago now, all of the finalists had a minimum double master's. So if you want to get into an art or museum library, for sure you should have a master's in art history or an MFA minimum along with your master's of library science degree. So there are many in my home profession, which is called ARLIS, Art Library Society of North America, and that includes over 1,000 members with librarians from places like the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the Museum of Modern Art, universities, architecture schools, special libraries, and they all have degrees in art and art history and even, you know, PhD at times. So it's a long road. I was in school for, I think, 8 or 9 years, so you have to just really specialize. And the jobs are few and far between, but they do come up. But once people are in them, they tend to stay in them until they retire.
Well, I'd like to thank you so much for taking the time to join us to share your insight and advice with our audience. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Oh, thank you. The pleasure is mine.
That was Liv Valmsted, Art and Research Librarian at the University of Manitoba's Architecture and Fine Arts Library. I'm your host, Susan Cohn, and we thank you for listening to Art World Innovators here on UMFM 101.5 at the University of Manitoba. Join us again next Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. for more on today's innovators in the art world.